Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest for this special Friday bonus episode is Lauren Lee Smith, an actress and producer you've seen in films like Trick or Treat, cinema novels, and How to Plan an Orgy in a Small Town, and on TV in The L Word, CSI, The Listener, and This Life. You'll see her in December in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, and she stars in Frankie Drake Mysteries, premiering on the CBC this coming Monday, November 6th at 9 p.m. Lauren chose Requiem for a Dream, Darren Aronofsky's harrowing 2000 drama, starring Ellen Burstyn, Jared Leto, Jennifer Connelly, and Marlon Wayans descending into a nightmare of addiction. Flexing his muscles after the no-budget breakout of Pi, Aronofsky turned Hubert Selby Jr.'s novel into something that's kind of a morality tale and kind of an adrenalized rollercoaster ride straight into hell, relentlessly following its characters into misery and abandon. You know, for fun. But it's too well-crafted to be dismissed as exploitation, which I remember several critics trying to do at TIFF that year. It's art, plain and simple. This is someone else's movie.
Requiem for a Dream was a game changer for me. I was 20 years old when I saw this film. I had been acting for 2 years. And I watched this film, and it's the first film experience I ever had that gave me a physical reaction.
Okay.
I had like, it gave me, it just blew my mind in every way, shape, and form. The acting, the cinematography, the content. I couldn't wrap my head around how much this film like physically affected me. And it made me take a long, hard look at sort of my career and where I was and what I was doing at that time. And it made me, it sort of propelled me to push myself. And sort of from that moment forward, from watching that film, I was like, I want to do things that challenge me, that push boundaries, that are darker and edgier and morbid. Because up until that point, I had very much played sort of the girl next door, very sweet, lovely characters. And I think I'm a pretty sort of down-to-earth, nice girl. And I really wanted to sort of break free and go outside myself and delve into the real world of acting and into character work. And for me, a film like this and sort of going into the morbid, dark world of addiction. It just opened my eyes up to sort of a whole new world of cinema.
had you seen Aronofsky's previous? Had you seen Pi before?
I hadn't. Okay. No, I watched Pi after. This was sort of really my first introduction to Darren Aronofsky, and to this day, he's still one of my favorites. I haven't seen Mother yet, which I'm dying to see. Yeah. Is it?
Yeah. See in the theater if you get the chance.
I would love to.
It's an enveloping. I mean, I saw it at, I guess, 9 a.m. at the press screening, but yeah. It's like being shaken for two right. straight hours, and when you figure out what it's doing, it's right. just even better.
Okay, yeah, amazing.
He's one of the filmmakers that I love him most when he is just going all out.
Yes.
He's less interesting to me in sort of working man's mode, right. I guess, like The Wrestler or something like that.
The Wrestler, absolutely. I agree. When you sort of... when you just sort of go with the imagery and go with... Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and Requiem for a Dream is... I mean, my initial response to hearing someone say, oh, this inspired me to try more things, is like what? I mean, it's about suffering, but it's such profound...
Yeah.
The message is so... All of it, I mean, almost every one of his films ends in tragedy.
Yes, yes.
They race towards oblivion
yes.
in a way that feels great,
yeah.
you know, while you're in it. The Fountain, the greatest thing that can happen is that Hugh Jackman can stop existing. That's
yes.
his goal
yes.
in the end. And this film does seem like a mission statement of grabbing and shaking and
absolutely
and waiting for the destruction that we just that train is coming from the first
yeah.
frames.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were 20. I was in my 30s when I saw
20.
It. I was walking back and forth.
I know. I just but it, for exactly those reasons for what you're saying. It hit me like a train. It was just like, how can something make me feel this way? And how can I, as an actor, be able to do that to someone else? Like, how can I be a little part of creating a film or, you know, a television series or a play, whatever it is? How can I grab someone and rip their guts out as well and make them have a physical and emotional reaction with a performance?
For the listener, huge smile, just grinning ear to ear. This is exhilarating. I love it. I love people responding to art like this. But it is such a, well, which character did you identify with the most? Was there a hook that grabbed you?
Well, I mean, Ellen Burstyn just like tore me apart in that. I still think it's one of the most insane performances. And when I watched the making of, I just, that sort of time lapse that they did of her cleaning the place, like, it still gives me goosebumps. It still gives me shivers. And sort of that process and how they just let her go for, I don't, you know, however long they could. But that performance to me will always be one of the most profound performances I've ever had the pleasure of watching.
Yeah, it is something. And people, I remember at the screening I saw, which would have been just before, I guess, before TIFF, because it played, people were saying, oh, I didn't know Ellen Burstyn could do that. It's like, you don't know who Ellen Burstyn is.
Right.
Because she's this, it's a revelatory performance only because she'd sort of been away for a while,
for a
right?
While.
So she's come screaming back in this.
And into this performance,
this powerhouse,
right?
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I'm sure if they had nominated her for supporting instead of lead, she probably would have won the Oscar.
I agree.
It's that unquantifiable performance. She is the centerpiece of the film, but doesn't have enough screen time. And just it's electrifying to see people go all out for this. And it tells me that they trust Aronofsky.
That's right.
Which goes through all of it. I mean, every subsequent movie, he's got people just go under the mattresses for him, and he'll do whatever.
They will do whatever, right?
Yeah.
I know, it's true. And a funny little backstory with Requiem for a Dream. When I was first asked which film yesterday to pick, my second choice was going to be the film that initiated me wanting to act in general, which was Labyrinth, when I was 8 years old. Also Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah.
And that's the film that I watched. And I was like, I was looking at the television. I looked to my mom and I'm like, I want to go in this world.
Right.
I want to be a part of this world. And my mom was like, well, you want to be part of Jim Henson's world with the puppets? And I'm like, I don't know what I want, but I want to do that. And going and watching Jennifer Connelly in, you know, her being sort of my very, very first inspiration, David Bowie as well.
Sure,
and then at 20, watching her do this blew my mind.
It was weird. Connelly was, I think there was that window where she was on the verge of being forgotten.
Right.
Just for about a minute, right around the hot spot.
Yeah.
So she was sort of regarded as a teen actress trying to become legitimate.
Right.
And then back to back, there was this Dark City, and this Dark City came first.
Yes.
Then
yep.
Requiem for a Dream, and then A Beautiful Mind, and everybody just shut up about it.
And
it's like, oh, no, she's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, she's worked, by this point in her career, she worked with Argento and Henson and done whatever Dark City required of her, because it wasn't the most challenging role, I suspect.
Yeah.
But you can feel it when an actor is seizing that moment.
Yes.
And she does have a kind of a go for broke, all or nothing thing.
Yeah.
And I still have issues with the degradation, with the way that the women suffer differently than the men in this film. But it's gendered because it's appropriately gendered, if that doesn't sound wrong. This is the path that's set out for them, not just by the drama, but by the concept of addiction and by
addiction.
Where people go. And,
exactly. No, it opened my eyes to so many things and so many that, you know, I just hadn't, you know, I've done literally two drugs in my life. One of them was by accident.
Okay.
So again, like, this to me was like, I had no concept of addiction or what it could do to you or how it manifests. And it just sort of, It made me curious in a sense of wanting to be able to do research and have an excuse to portray the struggles that these characters have to go through. And I was really sort of yearning to get to delve into sort of a darker world in an artistic level,
right.
Not on a personal level.
that's the actor's empathy, right?
Like, yeah.
You want to know about it. I myself have tried pot, didn't enjoy it.
Right.
And knew people when I was in my early 20s who were doing too much coke. And it's okay. Just like, okay, not.
Exactly. Same with me. I was like, nope, yeah. This is not.
And there's, you know, this endless moralizing coming from everyone who just sees them as an absolute evil. I'm sure there are people who self-medicate. I'm sure there are people who need this stuff. And it does seem to, people seem to enjoy them sometimes.
Right.
But then you get this movie, which it basically, I think you should strap down 16-year-olds and just show them everything.
Yes.
This is probably more likely.
This is, yeah, exactly. It should be required viewing in high schools.
Yeah, and coming right on the heels of Magnolia, too, someone else making an incredibly intense cinematic experience. There was that moment in 99 and 2000 when just everything went all out for about 6 months.
It was so amazing.
Yeah.
It was such an amazing time for film, yeah.
Well, yeah, and you're... You know, just coming out of your teens and watching all of these movies, I just that laundry list, you know, Three Kings and Fight Club and Being John Malkovich and Magnolia and this, and I know I'm forgetting one major one, but there was that, well, for me it was Rushmore, but
Rushmore,
just this sense that things were about to change, and then the wave broke and everything got really conventional for a little while.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, it was a while before now Aronofsky made another movie as daring.
Right.
And, so what happens when you see this film, you just come out of it and you're... Presumably, did you go right back? Did you want to see it again?
I did. I watched it. I immediately watched it again, and then I watched The Making Of. And honestly, I think I called my agent like immediately after. I'm like, I'm dyeing my hair dark. I'm doing whatever I can to take away this girl next door stigma. I want to find these sort of darker. The darker characters, the darker stories. I want to challenge myself and learn about all of these sort of the morbidity of life, and so that sort of became my mission for the next few years.
Yes, I'm trying to do the math in my head. So Lie With Me would have been like the next year.
Lie With Me was very close after that. And that was my very first film experience. And in a sense, I am so grateful because going with exactly what I was just saying, like I had to, there were so many, like I had to sort of physically bare myself, emotionally, mentally, strip myself down, like in every aspect.
Sure.
And it was so terrifying and so freeing, and it really sort of opened up the sort of floodgates for me in a sense of like realizing, okay, you can do something, and you sort of start to crave that feeling that like, I'm terrified to do this,
right,
but I want to do this.
So you're chasing a high.
Yeah, I guess.
Basically.
In a sense. There you go. Yeah.
Well,
full circle.
I think that happens with a lot of people who push into art. I mean, Aronofsky talked about it on the Black Swan interviews that it's about the high of the perfect performance. It's about the peak. And I always find it interesting when people make movies about addiction that are strictly literal, physical, you know, drug addiction, you know, something like Bigger Than Life, whatever it is you're doing where you can simply spend 2 years of your life feverishly making this thing, which is ultimately about someone feverishly doing something.
Yeah.
It's just this weird barrier, like the blood-brain barrier. The filmmaker doesn't quite seem to know that they're making a film about their own need to
about
create.
That, right, yeah.
But it's a fascinating process. And, you know, more often than not with a film, nobody dies. You suffer differently.
Yeah.
But there is so much energy invested into it.
Yeah.
And so much, so much personal commitment and time, and people lose relationships, people lose friendships, all this stuff that happens, and it's all in this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just glad that Aronofsky, 20 years later, is still happy and working and working with the same people, apparently, that like him.
Yes,
But
it's his art, and that's,
But you feel, watching the movie, like, you feel like the film itself is going to lose its mind at any moment. It's so jittery and nervous, and, I mean, my line at the time was, yes, some of the characters do heroin, but the movie is on speed along
it's
with Burstyn.
Completely, yeah. And I mean, it's the first film that I had seen, too, using those jump cuts. And just between the editing and the cinematography, I'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
Which I think really added to sort of that feeling, sitting on the edge of your seat and sort of vibrating along with them, you know, this crazy energy.
Yeah. It's funny. There's that little wave of drug films in the 90s, too, that came out with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, or the attempt to show what that
Basketball Diaries.
Yeah. And there's another one that I always forget. Blow came right around the corner.
Oh, okay.
With Depp and Penelope Cruz next year after this. And this is the only one where I feared for the filmmaker, if that makes sense. Yeah. And the actors, it's just, you get the sense that, I use the phrase high wire act a lot in this podcast, it turns out, because that's what I respond to. But you really get the sense that the making of this movie feels dangerous.
Right.
And it's not just the Jared Leto peacocking thing.
Yeah.
It's the environment that he creates. You know, when I see a Saw movie, I worry that someone on the set is going to get hepatitis.
Some sort of,
They're ugly and grotty. And this one even more so. Yeah. Just, you feel like you're wallowing in everybody's adrenaline sweat.
And panic. Very much so. That is so true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're telling me this made you want to do things harder, and I'm just like, oh, please be careful.
I know.
It seemed fine now.
It was completely just in a sense of wanting to experience a new type of acting that I hadn't done before. You know, everything was sort of very surfacey, I think, up until that point for me, and I wanted to dig a lot deeper and find characters that were very, very, very far from who I am, and who made choices that were very, very, very different from any kind of choice that I would make. So that's what I mean in that sense. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a pretty happy person, as you can see.
I'm glad to see it. I am. And that does sort of bring us to the final question, which you more or less already addressed, which is, what of the film have you borrowed or stolen or absorbed? But I guess, how does it factor into the work you're currently doing now? Because there's The Shape of Water in December and Frankie Drake Mysteries on CBC now.
Yeah.
That's the plug.
Yeah.
I hate when I do that. But how does it follow through?
I think it follows through in a sense that it from this point forward, Requiem for a Dream forward, there always has to be, for me, something that challenges me, where I didn't really have that the first couple of years of my career. It's not how I really looked at acting. I don't really know how I looked at acting. I guess it's sort of just take as it comes, and this is fun, for me, there has to be some kind of obstacle, and there has to be something that challenges me and helps me go outside of myself. Whatever that is, it doesn't necessarily have to be dark or morbid, but it has to incorporate me sort of going outside of myself and who I am, for it to be creatively fulfilling for me.
Have you chased a project like this? Has there been something that came your way that you...
Like Requiem for a Dream that I have chased? Definitely. There was a project that I ended up getting to do called Helen, which with Ashley Judd a few years ago, that was about mental illness. That was a very, very heavy movie, and it also dealt to a certain degree with addiction, and my character was this very fragile, very broken character, and I really wanted to play that role. I really, really wanted to play that role. So there was that. But I mean, there's been many occasions where I auditioned for The Wrestler.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I auditioned for The Wrestler, for the role of his daughter, which went to Evan Rachel Wood, who was amazing. But yeah, there's been a lot of roles that I've chased, a lot of those sort of morbid, dark, drug addicted, sex addicted, whatever addicted roles that that I've wanted to play for whatever reason or another. But I feel like, you know, not to sound too cliche here, everything happens for a reason, and I think the roles that I did get to play, like in Helen and Fly With Me, I think those were sort of just meant to be for whatever reason.
Yeah. No, you'll get to play your big addict role.
Right, just, one day.
Yeah, you come around again and you come at it from the bursting side. I don't know how to be encouraging on this.
It's so strange. It's a strange one. I know, right? It's true, yeah.
My thanks to Lauren Lee Smith, whose new series, Frankie Drake Mysteries, premieres on CBC this Monday, November 6th at 9 p.m. You'll also see her in theaters opposite Michael Shannon in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. I think it opens December 8th. You can find Lauren on Twitter at L_L_S, And you can find Requiem for a Dream on Blu-ray and DVD from Lionsgate in the US and Entertainment One in Canada. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. Oh, make sure you watch the director's cut. Otherwise, what's the point? As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever, that would be greatly appreciated. And don't do drugs. Thanks for listening.